This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Tropical force winds have already begun to batter the North Carolina coast. The storm has been downgraded to a Category 2, but that hasn't changed the storm surge forecast for Florence, and officials warn that Florence is still extremely dangerous. Checking around the state with a team of reporters and experts in North Carolina, our WUNC reporters have been covering governor's news conferences, emergency management procedures here in the state of North Carolina, shelters as well. We'll get updates from Wilmington, plus the environmental impact of the storm as this moves through the state. But first, let's talk with a meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Raleigh. Scott Sharp is on the line with us. Hello, Scott.
Hi, good afternoon, Frank. Hope you're doing well.
I am doing well, but how about on the coast? What's happening down there right now?
Well, right now, we've already seen some initial bands associated with Hurricane Florence coming onshore or portions of the Outer Banks, and now actually coming into portions of the coastal plain at this time. Shortly after 12 noon, we actually had sustained winds of 55 miles an hour with a gust of 70 miles an hour at Cape Lookout. And we're seeing frequent gusts now in that 50 to 69-hour range across several coastal locations there along the coast of North Carolina. At 12 noon, Florence was actually located about 130 miles to the east-southeast of Wilmington. She is moving to the west-northwest, we'll call it northwest direction, at about 10 miles an hour. At the same time yesterday, she was moving close to 16, 17 miles an hour. So she has slowed a little bit, and we are expecting the system to slow even further as we go into the afternoon to the early evening hours. And as of 12 noon, the maximum sustained winds were estimated about 105 miles an hour.
Well, what can we expect in the next 24 hours? When will it make landfall, which, of course, is only it's a way of designating where the thing is, but that doesn't mean it's the greatest point of the damage. Obviously, a lot of damage being done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like you said, not too much to focus on the actual center and stuff like that. Right now, Florence is supposed to slow and go to a slow, almost a crawl as we go through the nighttime hours of night into early Friday morning. Eventually, it looks like the center of Florence will make landfall somewhere along the North Carolina coast in vicinity of Cape Fear, or maybe a little north of Cape Fear, between Cape Fear and Cape Lookout, and then continue a really slow west to southwest drift as we go through the day Friday and into Saturday. She's a very large system, still a very powerful system, and so one of the things we're looking at is a prolonged period of some very strong winds, especially across portions of the coastal plain. And again, like you said, the storm surge, we'll see lots of water coming onshore with the circulation around Florence. And people got to remember, we have tides, we have low tides, we have high tides, and those high tides come in cycles, usually about 12 to 14 hours apart. And so because of the slow motion, and she's slowing down to almost a stationary motion for about 24 to 36 hour time, there's going to be several cycles of an incredible storm surge there along the North Carolina coast. All the way through Saturday.
The size and the speed of this thing, the fact that it is so slow, is really what's going to is the most threatening part about this. Not its category or its wind speed, but the fact that it's going to be churning rain and rising water levels for a long, long time along the coast. What about the rest of the state now? Do you have any projections for the impact, let's just say over the next 24 hours, on other parts of the state?
Sure thing. Yeah, as we hear in the Triangle area, here across parts of the Piedmont and areas along I-95, conditions will be deteriorating as we go later on this afternoon, but more so tonight and into tomorrow. Here in the Raleigh area and then here in the Triangle, the afternoon should be fairly decent. But again, the conditions will start to deteriorate as we get past supper time, but more so overnight tonight into Friday, where we'll all start seeing the winds pick up out of the north-northeast a little bit. We should start seeing some gusts around 30 to 35 miles an hour here across the Triangle, probably after midnight, and see those gusts increase to about 40, maybe as high as 45 miles an hour during the day on Friday. As far as the steady torrential rainfall, that will also be increasing. Expect some bands of showers to come across the area as early as this afternoon, possibly as far west as the US 1 corridor. But the more prolonged rainfall will start occurring later on tonight, again after midnight, and more so during the day on Friday.
And I've seen the path of this thing, pardon me for interrupting, but the path of this thing then takes it up into the mountains, right? It veers south, then west, and up into
eventually,
the mountains.
Eventually, it's going to meander across the state of South Carolina. It looks like through most of the weekend. And then it looks like as an area of high pressure builds or extends across parts of the northern Mid-Atlantic, southern New England states, that will help to propel the remnants of Florence up along the spine and Appalachians early next week. Because of the circulation around Florence, she's still going to be able to pull a lot of moisture off the Atlantic and up right across the Piedmont foothills and mountains of North and South Carolina and southern Virginia. So we're looking at another area of possible focus, of detrimental effects will be across the foothills and mountains as we go from the weekend into early next week, with the potential for some pretty decent flooding across that part of our state.
All right, Scott Sharp, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Take care now.
Scott Sharp is a meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Raleigh. A lot of people on the coast have already felt the effects of Hurricane Florence. In fact, they've been feeling it for days and weeks because they've had to evacuate, and they're waiting out this storm far from home. Chrissy Becker lives 17 miles from the coast in Jacksonville, but has had to evacuate. She's now in Hickory, and she joins us now. Chrissy, welcome.
Oh, hi, Mr. Stacey. Thanks for talking to me.
Thank you for talking with us. Tell us about the evacuation. What was that like for you? You were a county employee, so you had to stay to the bitter end, right?
Right. I had to stay until the county gave us a mandatory evacuation order. My husband is a Marine, so he had to stay until his command released him. The military didn't give us a mandatory evacuation notice. So we had to stay up until late Tuesday night, and then we frantically packed up with our two little girls and our dog and our cat and ran to Hickory.
What's that like, packing up, you know, in the face of a storm like this?
It's awful. It's absolutely awful. Because you look around at everything you own, and you can only take so much. And I have my two little girls, and so we had to tell them to pick out some special treasures that they wanted to take, but can't alarm them. So you pack up what you can, and eventually you hit a point where you have to stop, because otherwise you're just going to keep trying to you know, save everything.
Yeah, I cannot imagine. You're in a hotel now in Hickory watching all this unfold. What's that like? How do you even do that?
It is the weirdest feeling. I want to go home. I want to stay. There's about half of the residents that we have talked to so far are also evacuees from the coast. And in the morning at breakfast, you can tell the people who are just visiting and they're chatting. And then the rest of us are around the TV watching the Weather Channel and drinking coffee and not talking.
How are your daughters doing?
They're doing okay. They were really nervous when we first left. I have a 6- and an 8-year-old, and my 8-year-old was her tummy was upset, and she was really unhappy to leave. But we've been here. They've been in the pool. We're trying to make it as much of a vacation for them as possible.
What goes through your mind as you're watching these forecasts, glued to the Weather Channel, I'm guessing, and local television, as you see these reports and you think about your home? What's happening? What goes through your mind?
I'm terrified. Because everybody has left our neighborhood, so I won't know the condition of my house most likely until I get back. I don't know when I'll get back. I'm worried about wind damage. I'm glad the wind seems to be less than what we thought it would be when we left, but now with the rain, I expect my house to be flooded when I get home. It's the uncertainty and the anxiety is just, it's awful.
Chrissy, our hearts are with you, and I deeply appreciate you taking this time to talk with us.
Well, thank you for listening. I appreciate it.
Chrissy Becker is a Jacksonville resident who has had to evacuate with her family. She's in Hickory, North Carolina, and we wish her the best, certainly. WUNC Capitol Bureau Chief Jeff Tabiri has been looking at what's happening at the state level in terms of emergency preparedness. He has also visited a shelter in Knightdale, and he joins us now. Hello, Jeff.
Hey there, Frank.
What's the latest now from the command center? You've been there and hearing from the governor and emergency preparation officials. What are they saying?
Governor's been giving two updates for the past couple days. Spoke at 10 this morning. We'll speak again at 5 this afternoon. As of this morning, he still struck a very urgent tone, updated the folks to say that there are 108 shelters now open. And just for context, that compares to about 16 just 24 hours ago, and that has steadily increased. The estimate is about 7,000 people who have evacuated, who have heeded those words from the governor and other emergency management officials who have left. About 7,000 folks who have left are in those shelters right now. There's a mega shelter open in Winston-Salem at the Joel Coliseum where the Wake Forest basketball teams play. And it sounds like there's also the possibility of other mega shelters coming online within the next 12 to 24 hours.
You visited one of those shelters, or I'm not sure if it was a mega shelter, but a shelter in Knightdale.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I went over to Knightdale High School, one of three shelters in Wake County. All three of those shelters are at capacity. I was there early yesterday afternoon, and they were not letting reporters in yet. They were still registering folks, registering service animals. But I did speak with a couple who were outside. They were having a smoke break, Jeff Woldridge and Mae Buchanan, and they were thinking about riding out the storm in Carolina Beach. They live on a 38-foot sailboat named Supertramp, and Mae had put on her Facebook page that they were planning to stay, and she was inundated with comments and remarks from friends and family urging her to leave. So they actually went out in their sailboat. They tied it up a couple miles offshore because they thought it had a better chance of weathering the storm out there. They took a dinghy in and Uber to a local emergency shelter. We're told there that that wasn't going to hold, wasn't going to be a good place for them. So they got on a bus. They spent 4 hours heading up to Raleigh. And they were, I guess you would say, doing as well as can be perhaps expected. They brought clothes with them. They didn't have time to go get food and other needs. So, I mean, there certainly was fear, but they were both appreciative of the mood in the shelter. It said people were very respectful, people were getting along well, and also the fact that they're not going to be in the middle of this thing.
All right, we will check back with you. Jeff Tiberi, Capital Bureau Chief, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We're going to continue our live coverage of Hurricane Florence just ahead on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, today bringing you live coverage of Hurricane Florence from around the state. Hurricane now stands as a Category 2 storm. The winds, tropical winds, have already hit the coast. Still high velocity winds and, of course, heavy, heavy rains. The storm surge forecast have not changed. So a mighty storm surge, even though the wind speeds have slowed, a very, very dangerous storm. Vince Winkle is a reporter with partner station WHQR in Wilmington, and he is there right now. Hello, Vince.
Hello, Frank. How are you?
Well, I am fine. How are you?
We're good. We a little alarmed this morning when we saw the new National Weather Service prediction of 35 inches of rain here in a two-day period, which is 15 inches more than Wilmington's three-day record, and this is in 2 days. Wow. So we heard about that. So even though the winds are now down to Category 2, 35 inches of rain in 2 days has a lot of people concerned.
Yeah, it's a slow-moving storm, and the forecast call for it just to sit there and churn. What's it look like right now in Wilmington?
It's windy. It's not anywhere near hurricane strength wind, but this morning the breezes picked up, you know, through downtown. Our news director went for a long stroll this morning to get a scene from what was going on, and it was still calm enough that people are out walking their dogs, and then at least half a dozen TV crews are standing along the river doing live shots. And but it will pick up, and I think by 2 or 3 this afternoon we're going to have some pretty strong winds, and then, of course, Florence itself is set to hit us tomorrow.
Yeah, landfall, I guess, is scheduled at this moment. It looks like it's somewhere early Friday morning, but as we've said before, landfall really isn't. I mean, it's a nice marker, but the fact is that storm is coming. It's already begun to work its damage. How about storm surge? Have you seen any indication of that, waves rising?
We've seen the river rise, and yesterday actually I saw the creek behind my house creep up higher than I've ever seen it at high tide, and we're looking at a potential 13-foot storm surge, and that number was before the prediction of 35 inches of rain in 2 days. So the storm slows down, we get more rain, and the atmospheric pressure will keep pushing the ocean water down for a longer period of time. Means the creeks and the rivers and the retention ponds and tributaries are all going to be overflowing.
Down the north of this now, it's moved south from its earlier predictions, and that I keep hearing is the worst part of the storm. Talk about the difference between being north and south of a storm like this.
Right, because of the rotation of the storm, if you're on if you're north of the eye of the hurricane as it comes in, it's pushing more water and more weather in from over the ocean and creating a lot more pressure on the water as it pushes it inland. So that was another thing we learned this morning that is not making people here smile too much, but it is kind of a ghost town already. I mean, the shelters here filled up. A lot of folks went to Raleigh, to the shelters there, to stay with friends. That's what my family did. I know a lot of folks that went to Atlanta. And so there aren't too many people here, especially out in Carolina Beach and Wrightsville Beach. There's some diehards, but most people, I think, took the advice and left.
You were visiting some shelters, I understand. What was that scene like?
Well, they're packed. I think there was concern that one shelter in Wilmington wasn't suitable for the hurricane, so they moved those folks. And then, of course, yesterday they had buses. I think the last one left at 6 o'clock last night, the buses that left from Wilmington to go up to Raleigh to some of the centers there. My understanding is there are some centers in the Raleigh area that were just open for folks coming up from Wilmington and the counties in the Cape Fear region.
If you haven't left yet and you decide you want to, what should you do?
You should leave now.
Just leave.
The storm hasn't, you know, it's not raining yet. But if you're still here at noon or 1 o'clock, you need to find a place to hunker down.
All right, Vince. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
All right, we'll check in with you again. Vince Winkle, a reporter with partner station WHQR. He is in Wilmington right now. Joining us now is Jason DeBruin, WUNC's data reporter, who's been covering the ways in which different industries in North Carolina are preparing for Hurricane Florence. And that is significant because sometimes we're talking about toxic substances. Welcome, Jason.
Frank, hi. Good to be with you.
You've talked with Duke Energy. What are they doing to prepare for this storm? Some news this morning, I understand.
Right. So the big news this morning is that they're closing the Brunswick nuclear plant. They're in the process of shutting down one of the reactors, and they're going to shut the other one down later on this afternoon. This is newsworthy, of course, because that's a big operation, and the reactors are built exactly the same as the Fukushima ones that, of course, you'll remember were hit with a tsunami a couple years back in Japan. Now, that's not to suggest that we're looking at something similar, but certainly it is a concern when Duke shuts down big reactors like that.
Well, and what does that mean? What implications does that have for power generation? I mean, we're looking at a time when a lot of customers, upwards of perhaps 75%, I thought that's the last prediction I saw that Duke Energy said, 75% of its customers may lose power. What does it mean then to take a power station offline?
Well, I mean, you said it. There's going to be so many. The distribution lines are going to be down anyway, sort of across the whole network. So in some ways, you're looking at a power company not needing to generate as much power. But certainly even those who might not have their power lines down would potentially also lose power or see at least a reduced amount of power. But you also have to remember, a company like Duke has integrated networks so it can pull energy from other plants, even potentially in other states, to distribute that electricity.
All right. And let's talk about another issue, again, an environmental issue, coal ash, which involves Duke Energy. What's happening there?
Right. So there are these giant coal ash basins where you have the ash from the coal that's burned to generate electricity at these coal-fired plants that are then stored in these, really giant ponds. These sizes range anywhere from 35 acres to 300 acres or more. And what they do is the ash settles to the bottom of these, giant ponds or basins, and then they pour water over top so that, wind couldn't come and blow the ash across the state. Well, the concern, of course, is that, okay, there's water on top. Well, if you add a bunch of additional water into those basins, it could potentially overflow, and then you have a sort of ashen sludge that can really become part of the floodwaters and travel anywhere. So Duke has pumped down these coal ash basins so that they're at lower levels, and should also mention that some of these are coming offline, so some are already they have less ash in them today than they did, say, a year or 2 years ago. But, of course, the concern still is that we're getting so much water in this hurricane that even if they have been pumped down, even if they've been pumped down significantly, we're going to get so much water that they could, again, overflow. And then, you don't know what's going to happen to the ash.
And the coal ash ponds are really all across the state. But the rainfall amounts and the amount of flooding that we're going to have is a statewide question, right?
Exactly. I mean, you heard the number 35 inches, I think, just a few minutes ago. Now, that's at Wilmington, so, we're not necessarily expecting that much, maybe as you get closer to Goldsboro or into Raleigh or Charlotte, but that really still does remain a question, particularly as this hurricane continues to slow down. We'll continue to to sort of stay put over top much of eastern North Carolina, pick up additional water from the ocean, and continue to just drench everything. It's, you know, it's difficult to predict how much water you're going to get, and it could be a significant amount.
Now, hog confinement operations have also been another serious issue when it comes to this kind of weather in the state. What's happening there?
Very similar stories. So you consider this. You have 2,100 industrial-scale pork farms in North Carolina. That's 9 million pigs. And you have sort of a similar situation where a lot of this hog waste is put in retention ponds, and it's used as fertilizer, you know, at some point down the line. Well, here again, the hog waste ponds have been pumped down, and farmers are saying that they can take up to 2 feet of additional rainwater. But there again, what happens if you get 25 inches, 26 inches? What happens to the rainwater, the floodwaters that go into these, you know, catch basins and then potentially churn up that sort of sludgy, toxic, you know, hog waste, and then it spills over and carries it down again with the rest of the floodwaters that are sometimes near rivers, sometimes near where neighborhoods and really could go anywhere. So there is an environmental concern of not only coal ash but hog waste being mixed into some of these floodwaters and then draining into rivers and again, potentially into neighborhoods or even cities.
All right. Now, what about hospitals? We talked about potential power outages. What are they doing to prepare for potential flooding and power outages?
They're doing, you know, much in the way that they would normally do. The nice thing about some of these hospitals is they have, you know, significant backup generators where they can power up and you know, survive for 96 hours or even longer if they have loss of power. Obviously, a company like Duke or other power companies see these as, you know, really important spots, so they are some of the first to get power back. But I was chatting with some people in emergency preparedness in healthcare, and they were saying that one of their bigger concerns are patients who are getting in-home care. Maybe they just had a surgery, or, you know, maybe they have a lot of medications, or they're potentially even on oxygen. And what do they do? I mean, obviously, if they're in their homes, that they're only as safe as where their homes are, and who knows when they could get power back. And then, of course, also people that provide care to these patients, what do they need to be mindful of? Do they need to make sure that they're staying with their loved ones? Do they have the right medications? Do they have their medical record printed out so that it's not destroyed potentially during a flooding situation? Do they have enough oxygen again? So there are a lot of concerns among healthcare individuals about how patients are treated or how patients will survive the storm, you know, if they're at their own houses or if they're at their caretakers' houses.
All right, Jason, thank you so much for the update.
You're welcome.
Jason DeBruin, WNC data reporter. We're going to turn now to a researcher who studies how policies and decisions are made in response to these extreme weather events. Betsy Albright is an assistant professor of the practice of environmental science and policy methods at the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke University. Welcome back, Betsy. Good to have you here.
Hi, Frank. Great to be here.
You conducted a study in South Carolina after Hurricane Joaquin. That was in 2015, and you looked at the flooding there. What was that study about, and what did you learn?
So down in 2015, after the flood event happened, collaborators and I with several students went down, and we interviewed and surveyed flood survivors, folks who had experienced the flood, evacuated, and were in the process of either returning to their homes or still in shelters. And many folks were very generous with their time and spoke with us about their stories.
What were you looking for?
Looking for how people perceive the flood, what challenges they faced in the evacuation process, who were the most vulnerable to the floods, and how people were affected.
I would assume this could inform then policy decisions going forward. What did you learn?
So what surprised me the most of our findings was the how folks who don't own their homes, how renters were affected in terms of their particular vulnerabilities to the flood events. And that included people who lived in apartment complexes whose cars were parked behind gated security gates that were shut down because of power. They lost their cars. It had to do with getting FEMA reimbursements. People that are renters found greater challenges in getting reimbursed for the property that they owned.
So that's not too surprising, unfortunately, that the most vulnerable people are the most severely affected.
Yes, that is true. But given that, it's also true that folks who independent of how much resources they have, that community networks and ties really mattered. The role of faith-based organizations, neighborhoods, friendships, people that were had greater connections with the community ended up faring better than those who were newer to the community and had fewer connections.
That's interesting. When you say faring better, does that mean in terms of how they recover? How do you measure that?
That's a very hard thing to measure, actually. At this point, we were measuring it based on their perceptions of how they felt they were doing, their levels of stress and reported stress at this point.
What are the implications, do you think, for policy going forward? Having learned this, do you have any sort of particular bullet points that you might suggest?
The number one bullet point for individuals is many folks were surprised that they were flooded. They didn't realize that they were living next to streams or ditches that filled up because of the extreme rain, 20 inches plus, similar to what's predicted to Florence. Right. For cities and counties and rural communities, it's really getting in front of the storm, warning people, getting the message out, and not just, you know, on the news, but do it in a multimedia, multi-language to reach as many homes as possible.
What are your concerns now as you watch Florence unfold in this storm? What was your thought process? What are you thinking?
So in addition to studying how the public reacts and learns and adapts from floods, I also look, or we also look at how local communities react. Excuse me. And one of my main concerns is that many communities, counties in North Carolina are still recovering from Hurricane Matthew and still are in the process of getting reimbursed for that hurricane. And as excuse me, as well as the previous speaker spoke about the environmental risks that are always present or already present on the coastal plain. And so what I'm most concerned about is how are under-resourced communities down east in the coastal plain going to weather another extreme event when they're still recovering and haven't been able to deal fully with past events as well as the environmental risks that are already on the landscape.
Well, talk more about that, because you've said that we really shouldn't think about hurricanes as separate from environmental issues, that obviously this is the environment, but we should start to see it that way in that context.
Right. I agree completely with that. As the previous speaker said, there's coal ash ponds, there's concentrated animal feedlot operations, and communities that are most vulnerable, historically oppressed communities, communities of color, often live on more marginal land. They're oftentimes closer to water bodies, rivers, streams that are more likely to flood. And so thinking, we can't think silo and think floods, you know, just in the flood framework, but think about more system-wide risks, both in terms of recovery and like long-term economic development and livelihoods of people down on the coastal plain.
Well, and yeah, and the way you plan. I mean, if you're going to allow people to live in those places, then you have to think about what their needs are going to be and who in particular, you know, what kinds of networks they have. And so that kind of, it seems to me that kind of research is what a community would be well to do if we're paying attention to those communities.
Yes, and there's oftentimes a friction between wanting to recover quickly and wanting to recover well.
What about, are there places that you have found in your research that are doing it well, that places that you found have really taken this seriously and are have become to some degree a model?
Yes, I would. There are a few, although I'd say most communities tend to learn or adapt marginally or incrementally after a storm. They may make minor adjustments to emergency response or how reimbursement processes are done. But very few communities think more holistically in terms of long-term planning and where they should build, where they should not build, how they should build.
And our problem, of course, is the way we cover it and the way we think about these things. It's an emergency, right. And then we mop our brow and say, whew, that's over. And we think about it as over and don't want to go back.
Right. You know, we've been following communities in Colorado. It's just their fifth year anniversary from an extreme flood, and they're still working on recovery once the media is long gone, you know, after the event.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your insights. Betsy Albright is an assistant professor of the practice of environmental science and policy methods at the Nicholas School of Environment at Duke University. Betsy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
There's more coverage just ahead on the state of things. We'll take a look at sea level rise and what effect that's having on these events as our program continues. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, and our coverage of Hurricane Florence continues with an expert who studies sea level rise and how it affects beaches. Orrin Pilkey is James B. Duke Professor Emeritus of Geology at Duke University. He's written a number of books. He recently co-authored Retreat from a Rising Sea, Hard Choices in an Age of Climate Change, and he joins us now. Welcome back, Orrin.
Pleased to be here.
Tell us about what do you expect now as you're looking at these projections for this storm? How do you think this is going to affect the Carolina coast?
Well, it's one of the more dangerous aspects of it is that it's moving very slowly, which means it's going to pump a lot of water up the estuaries, causing flooding, and perhaps when the water comes back, forming inlets across Barrier Island. And there'll be a lot of beach erosion when it's slow. The waves will just sit there and pound the beach and pound the beach. And nourished beaches, that is, artificial beaches that have been pumped up recently, will probably erode quite a bit faster than, definitely will erode quite a bit faster than natural beaches. I would expect we might have some inlets, new inlets form on the outer banks. I think that'd be one of the major events. There's nothing wrong with that. That's all just a natural process. Mm-hmm. The way to look at it, I guess, is that the island is just doing its natural thing. But unfortunately, we're in the way. So
well, and you've said that really for the Outer Banks and those barrier islands, this is a natural process. Hurricanes can in some ways be good for them. They change, but they change in ways that, as you say, is natural and part of their process.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, barrier islands require storm for their survival. They're an important part of the processes. And in fact, barrier islands actually migrate. As sea level rises, they will move. And it is storms that makes migration of barrier islands possible.
We talked about sea level rise. What kind of impact is that having on these storms lately?
Well, it basically, as the sea level rises, the waves will be higher, the flooding will be higher, everything will be at a higher elevation. We expect probably, we're looking at, well, probably a consensus is somewhere around 3 feet by the year 2100, but recent observation on the Antarctica, both on the East Antarctica and West Antarctica, indicate pretty good chance that it's going to be more than 3 feet, and we're looking probably at 4 or 5 feet by 2100.
Melting is now reported on the eastern part of the gap. That's new, isn't it?
Yes, that's new. A recent couple of papers just came out. Indicating for the first time that East Antarctica is actually melting almost as much as West Antarctica. So that's quite a startling thing.
So that really has implications. We were just talking with your colleague, Betsy Albright, over at the Nicholas School about policy implications. What do we do in the aftermath of this? We've had a number of these hurricanes, obviously, in North Carolina. And you have argued, certainly in your latest book, Retreat from a Rising Sea, that we're not really taking the lesson here.
No, that's so true. It's kind of discouraging to me. What's happening is after hurricane, I first saw this in Hurricane Hugo, where we had a lot of damage, especially in northern South Carolina, and I thought that now that we've seen this happen, we're going to have a different policy on the beach. But instead, what we all observed was urban renewal. We basically. Mom and pop, one-family cottages became, large three-story buildings with 15 bedrooms and so forth with lots of rental space, and so basically one way to look at it is the hurricanes are actually causing our shoreline to be more densely developed, which is so ironic.
Ironic, but it's so. Does that have environmental implications? I mean, it seems to me if people who with that kind of money want to spend that kind of money and lose a house and pay for the insurance, well, let them.
Well, that's one way to look at it. But the problem is that we're paying. You know, the shoreline's eroding, and we wouldn't have beaches in most of our communities in North and South Carolina that are developed communities, unless we were using tax money to pump up new beaches, to replenish beaches. And in other ways, we build bridges, we build highways, we do a lot of things to help people exist on these barrier islands. And yet we somehow have concluded that we can hold the shoreline still, but it's very clear both environmentally and economically that we cannot hold shoreline still.
One of the things that you have seen is that in this attempt, the King Canute effect, as it were, to hold back the sea, that we very often that's when you start to see seawalls go up, right?
Yeah, we learned in New Jersey back in the early part of the previous century that seawalls destroy beaches, putting it very simply. And of course, if you protect your buildings with seawalls, then you end up being a beach community without beaches. So then the question is, what's more important, beaches or buildings? It's a complex question.
Well, but as you say, as bigger buildings get built and replace the smaller ones with each successive storm, the answer is going to be buildings because that's where the money is, right?
Yeah. The problem with the bigger buildings is that they make it less and less feasible to retreat, to move the buildings, to get out of the way, which is what we should be doing now. We should start to do this now.
What does that look like, though? A kind of a rational reasonable retreat from the sea.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think one merciful way to do this is to not allow buildings that are destroyed in storms to be replaced. Maybe we'll have to pay something for these houses. We can move buildings back. We can demolish buildings that are in danger. That's already being done in some communities in Virginia. We can, for the time being, we can raise buildings, but that's only a temporary solution. And any way you look at it, we have to move back from the shoreline one way or t'other.
Well, I'd like you to stick around with me for a little bit longer, if you would, Orrin, but I want to introduce another guest right now, and that's Casey Dietrich. Casey is a professor in North Carolina State University's Department of Civil Construction and Environmental Engineering, and he uses computer models to understand the effects of storms on shorelines and then convey those risks to public officials. Casey Dietrich, welcome.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for talking with me.
Good to talk with you, and thank you. What do we do? What are the most important factors when you're trying to predict the effects? You know, we're finally trying to learn that just talking about where the eye lands is not the most important part of a hurricane or its wind speed. So I guess we're slowly being trained out of that model. What should we be looking for?
So I'm part of a research team here in North Carolina and around the country, and we develop a model called ABSTRC, and we run it in real time during these events. So every 6 hours, we're putting out a new forecast. And there's a lot of uncertainty, even in the forecast of the storm surge and the flooding. So we depend, our flood models depend on the storm forecast from the National Hurricane Center. And so any uncertainty in their forecast of the storm track or the storm forward speed or the radius to maximum winds will propagate into our model forecasts of the storm surge and the coastal flooding. And so there was some uncertainty this week with the landfall location, but really that affects how the winds are blowing as the storm's approaching and where the storm surge might develop in other parts of the coast. So there was a couple of forecast advisories there on Monday or Tuesday when the landfall was a little farther north toward Emerald Isle, and our models were showing not as much storm surge and flooding on the open coast, but a real large impact in the Sound and up the Neuse and the Pamlico River estuaries. And now that the track has kind of moved a little further south toward Wrightsville, we're still showing impacts in the Sounds, but it's also a lot of flooding on the open coast from Emerald Isle down through Topsail.
Of course, hurricanes are infamous for their uncertainty, and we can understand all of the dynamic influences that go into such a large system. Is the uncertainty of a matter of just a lack of data points? Are you discovering more and more questions to ask and data points to include, or will uncertainty always be a big factor in trying to model hurricanes?
It will always be a big factor. I think a lot of these things that are uncertain, we're getting better understanding both about the storm but also about how the coastal ocean will respond. But there will always be uncertainty. And so one of our main research goals is to move to ensemble forecasts where we're not just running one simulation but running dozens of simulations, each with a slight perturbation to the storm and thus a slight perturbation to the water levels. And to get there, we really need to speed up our models. We need to be able to run them much faster. And so I'm working with colleagues and with support from NSF and the Department of Homeland Security to try to do that, to speed up our models and be able to run them more often during the storm.
Can models that are used to predict, let's say, storm surge and flooding also be used to predict erosion or other coastal effects after the storm?
So that's an active area of research. There are some really great models for coastal erosion, and some are used in real time. The USGS has some coastal erosion forecasts that they publish. But the tricky part there is the coastline is always evolving. The beaches and the dunes are constantly changing. And so we don't always know exactly what the beach and dune looks like today so that we can run a forecast over the next couple of days. So I've got a project with North Carolina Sea Grant where we're building coastal erosion models for Hatteras Island and looking at back at the effects of Hurricane Isabel. How can we predict the creation of the Isabel Inlet? How can we predict the dune erosion north of Cape Hatteras? And ultimately, how can we link those erosion models back to our storm surge and flooding models so that as the dune erodes, can we be pushing water into the community that was previously protected?
Well, let me put it.
And thus improving the accuracy of our model.
Right. Well, that raises a question for you, Oren Pilkey. Let me ask you about this because you've talked about some of the effects and you know, taking a look at the future, say we need to move back from the coast, look at what's happening, and made predictions about sea level rise, et cetera. How confident are you that those models are accurate enough given all the uncertainty in this?
I really agree with the term uncertainty. Uncertainty is hurricanes. I mean, it's just so many things happening. It's so complex and so many factors involved that I think the modeling is probably coming closer, but it'll never be precise. That's for sure.
Casey Dietrich, it's interesting to hear you talk about going back and looking at models. How important is that to take a look at all the data you have from previous hurricanes? Because not only do you have what the hurricane did, but you also have what it left in its wake and then how that has changed in the period since. So it seems to me that would be pretty important data for you if you're making a model.
It's really important, and it's really improved over the last 10 or 15 years. A lot of my PhD was building models for southern Louisiana for Hurricane Katrina, and I remember we had 8 gauges where we had a time series of water levels during the storm, so 8 locations where we could see how the tides turned into a large storm surge that threatened New Orleans. For Matthew, 2 years ago, we just submitted a manuscript, and there were 400 water level gauges that we were using to evaluate our model and ultimately improve it. And we just, my PhD student was at the coast the last 2 days helping North Carolina Sea Grant put out some wave gauges in Wrightsville Beach and Topsail. And we really want to see now how the storm surge and the waves are attenuating as they move over a barrier island. So how does, if the waves are 5 feet at the ocean side and they go down to 1 foot on the backside, how does that distribution occur as it flows over? And so those data points will be really helpful for us.
You know, you're both to be congratulated as scholars who embrace uncertainty. I think that's the way to approach this. But then when it comes to public policy, Casey, what do you do about that? Do you work with public officials to try to figure out ways that they can, in real time, particularly when the emergency is imminent, analyze this and interpret all of this?
We do, and we work with them year-round. Our larger research team is supported by DHS, and so we are working with colleagues at FEMA and the U.S. Coast Guard and kind of understanding what their needs are going to be during an event so that then we can be sharing our forecasts with them, and we have been. I'm connected with North Carolina Emergency Management, so the state-level emergency managers, and meeting with them as often as once a month over the last several years, trying to understand what they need. And then we've been sending forecasts to them, again, every 6 hours. And in terms of understanding uncertainty, we've been sending multiple forecasts, so maybe a handful of forecasts, one with the official track and all the official storm parameters, but also some perturbations where the track might shift left or right, or the storm might get stronger or weaker. And by communicating with our stakeholders ahead of time, they're better able to use those uncertain ensemble members as part of their decision making.
Orrin Pilkey, that's what we do sort of in the moment of crisis, and how to use these models and try to understand, both as public officials and the public, that, you know, there is a fair degree of uncertainty in all this. If, for the long term, and that's what we were talking about earlier in terms of public policy, it does seem that public opinion, public attention shifts in the immediate aftermath of the emergency. Everybody mops their brow and says it's over. Are we getting any better at paying attention to the long-term consequences of this?
Unfortunately, the long-term thing here that's so important is the impact of sea level rise, and what is sea level rise going to be in 10 years, 20 years, and so forth. And the state of North Carolina has chosen a relatively low sea level rise, just up to about 30 years, and it's basically 6 or 8 inches, whereas the consensus sea level rise is closer to 3 or 4 feet. By 2100. That's a much higher rate of sea level rise. And I think as a consequence of this low acceptance of a sea level rise just up to 30 years has allowed us to continue to develop our shorelines longer than we should have been doing. We should have been starting to consider retreating from the shoreline and not allowing more beachfront, absolute beachfront development, and so forth and so on. So in some ways, it's a matter of choice of what number you want to choose, because it's all controversial, and it's all a lot of uncertainties, of course. But 3 to 4 feet is by 2100 is a very good estimate, good way to, should be a good basis for coastal management.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Orrin Pilkey, James B. Duke, Professor Emeritus of Geology at Duke University, and Casey Dietrich is a professor in North Carolina State University's Department of Civil Construction and Environmental Engineering. Thank you both for being on the program.
Pleased to have been here.
Our coverage will continue on this station. Please stay with us. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.